So I wander around the terminal entrance like a homeless waif for 30 minutes, and I go back to the counter. She informs me that the system lockdown has been extended for another 15 minutes. I again ask for a supervisor or somebody who can override the system, let me clear security, get my boarding pass so I can be waiting in the lounge. Again, she tells me it's forbidden. To make me feel better, she informs me, "It's not just you. I'm turning away everybody on this flight." Somehow, that doesn't make me feel all warm and fuzzy. But I know better than to argue with the secret system. So I wait another 15 minutes and return. There's a new agent, and he informs me the lockdown has been extended another 15 minutes. I do a couple more Sudoku puzzles, and I return 15 minutes later. That agent is gone, and now another new one is on duty. She informs me that the system lockdown has been extended another 15 minutes. I point out that such an extension will now encroach on actual boarding time. She admits the flight won't actually take off on schedule, but claims it'll only be 15 minutes late. I return in 15 minutes and the system still isn't open. 5 minutes later, it finally opens up. I get my boarding pass and clear security, but now there's no time to go to the lounge. I have to rush to the gate where there are a couple hundred people milling around. The monitor still says the flight is leaving on time, but of course no one is boarding. An announcement informs us that the boarding will be late for a variety of reasons, unquote, but will start soon. The plane is sitting at the gate. Departure time comes and goes. The monitor still says the flight is leaving on time. Next, they make an announcement explaining why they can't pre-board first class. And here's what they said. The flight attendants are not actually on the plane because their luggage did not clear security. I have to admit, I've taken a couple thousand flights, but I've never heard that one before. They finally board the passengers needing special assistance. The flight crew arrives. They announce they still can't seat first class, and they seat economy. About 15 minutes later, they seat the first class and the elite members of their frequent flyer club. The plane, which is still posted to leave on time, closes the door an hour and 15 minutes late. But here's the most fascinating part of this whole arduous story I'm telling you. The original plane was a 777. The new equipment was a 777-300, which actually has the same configuration in first class, plus an extra 65 seats in back, all of which, of course, were empty when we took off. Perhaps you're wondering, why would it take so long to reassign passengers on a larger plane with all those empty seats? Or maybe you're puzzled as to why, if the first class seating was the same on the new plane, BA would work so hard to aggravate their most loyal and lucrative passengers. Maybe you're even wondering how millions of idiots could think an airline that can't competently schedule, board, and maintain airplanes could competently fly them at the highest reaches of the atmosphere at speeds more than 500 miles per hour. If you're wondering, ask the idiot who just typed that question at 36,000 feet and is reading it to you now. Let me tell you why. The reason we wait in empty cab stands, attend marketing conferences from people who don't know how to market, and trust incompetent airlines to fly us miles above the earth is the same reason companies build websites that drive away customers, damn prospects to voicemail hell, hold terminal meetings about crafting mission statements, create boring advertising, develop copycat products, and spend all their time worrying about what their competitors are doing instead of growing their own business. They buy the story. They go along for the ride because it seems like everyone else is going along for the ride, and no one likes to stick out. Sometimes even brilliant entrepreneurs create a breakthrough product or concept then let themselves devolve into the accepted practices and premises of that particular industry or field they set out to change. A perfect example I use in the book is JetBlue Airways. JetBlue is arguably the most successful aviation startup of the last three decades. Their success came as a result of a simple fact. They were willing to challenge the conventional wisdom of how to run an airline. When you think about it, they completely disrupted the airline industry. They were the only carrier who felt customers should have enough legroom for an actual human being, enjoy a comfortable padded seat, and not get charged to check a suitcase. They offered free Wi-Fi and satellite TV on every plane. Their economy service was as good or better than some of the bigger carriers' first-class cabins. Every other U.S. carrier worked to shoehorn in as many passengers as possible. Many equipped their plane with what they called the slimline seats that road warriors just detest, with ticky-tacky fees for everything from checking bags to reserving a seat. JetBlue changed the game, and they achieved almost instant success, developing the best reputation of any American airline, and they had a legion of wildly passionate customers. Then they started listening to the analysts. For a quarter or two, JetBlue trailed some of the legacy carriers in profitability, and of course the analysts started screaming. Of course, none of those analysts thought to mention that most of those other carriers had lost billions in the previous 5 years, even though JetBlue had great earnings during the same period. Or the fact that those other carriers had terrible reputations with beleaguered customers who endured them only because they were the only carrier in their area or they were hobbled by the golden handcuffs of the airline's frequent flyer programs. Wall Street analysts wrote critiques saying that JetBlue was overly brand conscious and customer focused and therefore had lagging fundamentals. One wrote, I read this, I couldn't believe, they said, "In our view, the benefits of a shift in ancillary policy and seat pitch significantly outweigh the potential customer backlash." So the C-suite at JetBlue bought the story. And next thing you know, the airline announced plans to start baggage fees, cram 15 more chairs on its Airbus A320s, and switch to those god-awful slimline seats. And instead of taking delivery of new planes, they said they were going to start refreshing old ones. Of course, the analysts all loved the news and promised investors that JetBlue would earn another $450 million over the next 4 years. But here's the question. If that system really did work, how come it never worked in the last 50 years for Delta, American, Pan Am, Eastern, U.S. Airways, Continental, and United? The response from JetBlue customers was visceral and immediate, and with social media, blogs, and the airline's Facebook page blowing up with angry, frustrated, and negative comments. The incoming CEO, Robin Hayes, told analysts the airline expected, quote, a lot of noise around the changes, but it would still be, quote, a better experience than you will have on any other airline. Translation, what does that really mean? We'll be slightly less crappy than the other guys. Unfortunately, given the embarrassing state of the U.S. airline industry, that's probably true. But it's an object lesson in how disruptive and innovative organizations can quickly fall into mediocrity and herd thinking. If you buy into the conventional thinking in your space, you end up an entrepreneur who thinks like an employee, which is very, very dangerous, because entrepreneurs who think like employees end up becoming employees. And entrepreneurs are psychologically unemployable. For years, I've told people, I'm psychologically unemployable, because if I worked for someone, I'm going to end up killing them or they're going to end up killing me. So in the interest of saving all those lives, let's look at how this dead-end thinking comes about and how we can change it. We think that because we trust the mysterious people in charge of this secret system, that they know what's best for us. But they don't. In fact, the mysterious people in charge of the secret system don't actually have a clue. They tell you to fit in, do what they say, and conform to the system because that's the way it's always been done, or that's the way we do things here. Let me tell you something about these mysterious people in charge of the secret system. They are crazy. Not just plain crazy, they are batshit crazy. Now, they don't know they're crazy. In fact, they'll probably suggest that you are the crazy one. They've been infected with so many negative mind viruses that they've lost the ability to think independently. They believe they're free-thinking individuals, but they're actually pre-programmed automatons. They're not evil people, at least not intentionally. They're just like those guys who were working at the London taxi stand or the gate agents at the airport that I referenced earlier. They're simply hardworking people who mean well, doing the job they were hired to do. Sometimes they run into rules and procedures or processes that seem crazy to them. But they assume the mysterious people upstairs know something they don't, and they perpetuate the craziness. In reality, they've simply become so infected with corporate think memes, they no longer reason rationally. They fill the cubicle farms, and they populate a lot of the C-suites as well. But if you want to break through, you've got to reject conformity and become a critical thinker. Walter Freeman was a doctor who got his degree in neuropathology in the 1930s. Despite having the degree, Freeman found there wasn't much he could do with it. Very few treatments existed for mental illness at that time. Patients ended up in sanitariums without pharmaceutical or surgical options. Until Freeman took an experimental European surgery and began curing patients in America with it. Today, we know this as the lobotomy. He was celebrated as a hero for the lives he changed and the field of psychosurgery he created. He improved the technique to the point where he could perform it as an outpatient procedure that was simple, cheaper, and safer than other treatments. It took vision and courage to create a cure by doing something no one else had even thought of trying. But you know how this story ends. As time passed, it became clear that the surgery didn't help every condition. Other, better options were created, and doctors moved on to those new treatments. The lobotomy became a historical stepping stone on the path to better, safer medicine. During that time, Freeman continued to champion the transorbital lobotomy, driving around the country doing thousands of procedures on anyone who would consent. Or, if we're being honest, more accurately, had someone consent on their behalf most of the time. Freeman went from hero to monster. The lobotomy moved from brilliant innovation to a bad punchline. Why? Because Freeman thought he could take one creative leap and then simply repeat it over and over. He kept doing the same thing, expecting the same results, and now the world thinks of him as insane. The ways we think. It was the Wednesday before the Thanksgiving holiday, and four workers were supposed to be renovating my master bathroom. I came home in the afternoon about 3:30 and found the shower door propped against the wall and all the workers were gone. Shocking, right? I mean, employees without supervision take off early for the holiday weekend because they have visions of football, six-packs, and Netflix. They're just doing what employees do, thinking like employees. Later that day, I was browsing in an art gallery, and I was vacillating between a couple different pieces of art when the owner did something shrewd. He offered to bring them over to my home, hang them up, and then leave them over the holiday weekend to see how I liked them. What happened, of course, he ended up selling me three pieces of art. No shock here either. He's just doing what smart business owners do, thinking like an entrepreneur. But there's a third group, and this is where the magic happens. I would call this group entreployees, but the buzzword these days seems to be intrapreneurs. Whichever word you use, what we're really talking about are employees who think like entrepreneurs. They're that minimum wage employee you see at In-N-Out Burger, constantly scanning the dining room, wiping tables, emptying the trash, and making sure the restrooms are spotless. They're the teachers who found a way to teach around the test instead of teaching to it. They might be the quality control guys who just realized their company can save substantial time and money by changing the order in which things are made or tested. Maybe they're the agency copywriters working on the next Apple product launch. Or they're the baristas at Starbucks who remember the name and order of all the regular customers. They're the engineer at Amazon, the clerk at Ace Hardware, or the director of development at a nonprofit. They may not own the place or even have a share of the profits, but you'd never know it by the way they approach their work. Instead of the just doing my job mentality, they approach every situation with an entrepreneurial mindset. This is the philosophy Ravin Sharma gives focus to in his book, The Leader Who Has No Title. It's the kind of culture Mark Sanborn is talking about in his book, You Don't Need a Title to Be a Leader. We're talking about empowered, energized people who get things done. So how do you create that kind of culture in your organization? It comes down to what I call the 20-70-10 formula. 20% of the people you hire will naturally gravitate to the lowest common denominator behavior. They want to do the least amount of work required to stay employed, look for ways to cheat you, and will mindlessly cost you customers until you weed them out. They corrupt your culture because their actions, or lack of actions, undermine the rest of the team that's trying to do good work. 10% of the people you hire will naturally gravitate to the higher levels of accountability. They're entrepreneurs at heart, and their job with you is probably a stepping stone on their way to one day opening a business of their own. Even though they may not stay with you forever, the relationship is win-win for both sides. You get an amazing employee, and they get the experience they need. They want to learn, are conscientious and loyal, and they wouldn't steal money even if you left it laying around. They think and act like entrepreneurs. Here's the really fascinating thing. Your culture, mission statement, vision, values, and work rules have almost no effect on either one of these two groups. So we're talking about 30% of your workforce. Who they are and how they behave were determined long before you got them by their parents, teachers, coaches, counselors, and other people of influence. Your real task is to influence the 70%. These are the people who can be influenced in one way or another, and the group where you can grow intrapreneurs. The organizations with amazing cultures, whether for superior customer service, innovation, or something else, they accomplish this by setting up a structure that influences this 70% in a positive way, and they are proactively vigilant at replacing the people in the bottom 20%. Several of the CEOs I'm strategic advisor to now have implemented these pay-to-quit programs with extraordinary results. One of them is offering programmers $5,000 to quit after their second week of employment. Another client of mine has a fairly large buyout of around $75,000 on an employee's one-year anniversary. They find that this helps cull the herd of people who really don't buy into the company vision and really don't want to be there. And I think it's interesting, when Amazon bought Zappos, they were so impressed with Zappos' pay-to-quit program, they adopted it company-wide. To create a world-class organization and nurture true entrepreneurial thinking, you have to program to the top 10%, cull the 20% on the bottom continuously, and nurture the 70%. The culture you set determines the thinking through all levels of the organization. And don't think it comes from providing free massages, Nerf ball courts, and hiring Gordon Ramsay or some celebrity chef to be in your company cafeteria. It doesn't. I got to tell you, some members of my mastermind group and I, we got an email from another member who was looking for advice. A problem had arisen with his biggest client over the weekend, and he was upset because no one took charge and handled the situation. So he was emailing us. He was looking for suggestions on how he could get his employees to be more diligent and take ownership when problems with clients came up. Here was my reply to the group. Well, at least we know one thing. Giving them a piece of the fucking profits doesn't work. Because here's the shocking thing. He had actually sold the company to his employees a few years earlier. He had this system with open books and all employees share in the profits. When he dies or retires, his remaining share of the business goes to the rest of the team. So if he's crying because no one is taking ownership, you can bet that your idea of installing a rollerblading ramp in your cafeteria isn't going to do it either. This is not to say that providing daycare or offering massages or some of these other employee perks is a bad idea. Just know that giving free lunches or other goodies has never turned a bad employee into a good one. Offer the perks to attract and keep the great people, but know you'll still have to weed out the ones who aren't a good fit. We'll look at ways you create a culture that facilitates critical thinking, innovation, and entrepreneurship in book number 3. But first, it would be helpful to understand why so many people don't think in creative, empowering, and entrepreneurial ways. Why is conventional thinking so backward and innovation killing? And, what is holding people back? What holds companies from breaking through on new developments and advances? Why is the default setting always it can't be done? To find the answer, we have to explore the realm of memes and subconscious programming. The lie of proof. We all have core foundational beliefs based on evidence we've seen firsthand. We did see it, right? In actuality, your core beliefs about the most important issues in life, happiness, money, relationships, love, sex, religion, all of those kind of things are usually formed before you are 8 years old. They're determined by what memes or mind viruses you've been infected with. And once you're infected with a meme, you develop core beliefs based on it. After that initial exposure, you seek out people, information, and experiences that prove these memes you believe are actually correct. But what is a meme anyway? You see the term meme today often used to describe a slide or a GIF that people put captions on and they put it on their Facebook page or somewhere else on social media. And they're called memes because each one contains an idea that everyone understands, whether we're seeing it for the first time or the 100th time, right? like the lazy college senior, am I the only one around here, angry Walter, or the, of course, the first world problems girl. A meme is an idea that's also a replicator. It's a mind virus you get infected with, just as your computer could be infected with a virus. Think of it as something that causes people to think in a certain way, believe a certain thing, or take a specific action. It's actually a unit of cultural evolution. A chart-topping hit like Pharrell's Happy is a meme, just as catchy jingles or slogans are. You hear it, you play it in your head, and then you infect other minds by sharing it. Just Do It and Where's the Beef are memes, just as is the idea that all rich people are evil. The word meme was first discussed in the 70s in a book by Richard Dawkins called The Selfish Gene. He took the Greek root of mimim and shortened it to meme to be suggestive of the word gene. A meme complex is a condition of mutually supporting memes that form a belief system. You've been infected not only with thousands of memes, but many meme complexes, most of which are not congruent with your own success and prosperity. Many of the most common memes in the world today, money is bad, rich people are evil, it's spiritual to be poor, and many others like this, actually cause you to self-sabotage your efforts. You work consciously for health, happiness, and success, but your subconscious mind works diligently to keep you sick, unhappy, and broke. This is equally true of the memes around business, companies, and the corporate world today. Even if you're an aspiring entrepreneur, it's difficult not to get infected with the prevalent subconscious programming about how successful companies are greedy, exploit workers, or they rape, pillage, and plunder the environment for obscene profits. Even if you get over all that, the danger lies in falling prey to the habitual or herd thinking that still dominates the corporate world. What if Buddha was wrong? Siddhartha Gautama Buddha never heard about memes and had no idea what they were. Yet he created some of the most powerful memes that still exist today. And here's something he once said. Believe nothing, no matter where you read it or who has said it, not even if I said it, unless it agrees with your own reason and common sense. That's sage advice. Unless it isn't. The culture we live in today is brainwashing and indoctrinating you with memes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is accelerated by the omnipresent media and all of the technology that streams it. So unless you have engaged in serious critical thinking, an evaluation of your core foundational beliefs and how you came to believe in them, what the Buddha calls your own reason and common sense, may be neither. You and your team may be consciously working to move forward, but subconsciously sabotaging your success with defeatist thinking or falling into the derivative thinking that produces mediocrity. When someone tells you something is impossible, what he usually means is it's difficult. When someone tells you it can't be done, you have to take a step back and figure out why it can't be done. Pull the reasons apart. There may be obstacle after obstacle, but buried in there with them is probably a meme, a mind virus, that doesn't belong. If a premise is incorrect,
everything that is based on that premise is wrong also. Don't let a minor practical challenge become a major mental obstacle. The mind of the entrepreneurial artist. Henry Ford famously quipped that if he had asked his customers what they wanted, they would have just said, faster horses. And with that jibe, he illuminated the enigma of entrepreneurial innovation. The ability to envision something that has never been seen before because it doesn't exist yet. Every great breakthrough or innovation is created twice. First, in the mind of the visionary, and second, in the physical world. This takes us back to Shakespeare, Quill poised over the inkwell, Michelangelo chipping away at that block of stone, or Verdi pondering what his heroine's next aria will be. Steve Jobs spoke to this issue when he was asked whether Apple conducted focus groups for the iPad. He notably replied that it wasn't his customer's job to know what they wanted. That's the entrepreneur's job. That's your job. And to do it, you're going to have to think bigger, bolder, and better. Genius is knowing what your customers want. Mad genius is knowing what they will want the moment they discover it exists. Book 2, The History of the Future. Ask the average person on the street why nobody discovered America before Christopher Columbus, and you'll usually get the wrong answer. Because everyone else thought the earth was flat. It's a comforting story, but Columbus had nothing to fear because he had facts on his side and everyone else had superstition. Except that wasn't really the case at all. In fact, it was Columbus who was wrong. The world was searching for the fastest route to Asia from Europe, as sailors had to sail all the way around the bottom of Africa. Columbus thought he could sail around the other way because he greatly underestimated the circumference of the earth. When Columbus set sail to the west, he may have known the trade winds better than all of his contemporaries, but no one really knew what they would find that far out in those seas. Columbus would have had every possible excuse not to take the trip. That's why no one attempted it before him. But Columbus knew that someone would eventually try to sail there by sailing west, and he wanted to be that someone. His greatest skill, really, was knowing the future would come eventually, and he still had time to make his own mark on it. And so do you. We are about to enter the decade of the most accelerated growth in human history. Between now and the year 2026, we will experience cataclysmic disruption in virtually every industry, profession, and business. Genetic engineering will offer parents the chance to pre-order designer babies, selecting everything from physical characteristics to intelligent factors to personality types. Human cloning will violently disrupt the job market, the economy, and the very fabric of society. Health and wellness will morph into a multi-trillion-dollar industry with nutrigenomics, biohacking, creating tidal waves in this sector. Right now, most healers, pharmaceutical companies, hospital chains, and insurance providers are decades behind the curve and need to radically rethink their approaches. Virtual stores, stocked simply with QR codes or something similar, will create shocking disruption for traditional and online retailers. They're going to face serious market share erosion from the expanding direct selling and network marketing industry.
At some point really soon, retailers will have to face the reality that they are still trying to operate from a business model that was created more than 200 years ago. One that hasn't evolved, but arguably has devolved, with more layers of parasites between the manufacturer and end consumer now than there were two centuries ago. Digital wallets will replace credit cards and debit cards and even threaten currencies. Open source peer-to-peer electronic money like Bitcoin and payment networks change the game even more. If you're in banking or the financial sector, you certainly won't survive at today's level of thinking. Three-dimensional printing will create the most seismic shift in manufacturing since the advent of the industrial age. Billionaires will be created in the smart appliance space. It's time to think about manufacturing in a whole new paradigm. And these printers will impact virtually every industry. As I'm talking to you right now, doctors in Michigan have already used a 3D printer to custom design a life-saving implant for a sick baby. The entertainment industry, one of the largest industries on earth, is already experiencing disruption on a seismic scale, and it's only going to intensify. The lines between broadcast, cable, and internet-created content are disappearing. The lines delineating which screens can be used to view that content have pretty much already disappeared. I predict a new entity, which I'm going to call Virtual Reality Gaming and Gambling Studios, or let's call them VRGGSs. They will sweep the world and become a multi-trillion dollar industry almost instantly. Much like the battle for market share in the VRGGS, most of the same players and a horde of others will be frantically clashing over who controls streaming video from the cloud. Just how big is the pie they will be fighting for? At the time I'm writing this, so the numbers will be even higher when you're listening to this, YouTube gets 4 billion video views, more than 80 million hours a day. Facebook gets another billion. From 9 p.m. to midnight, Netflix is responsible for one-third of all downstreaming traffic on the internet. The average person in the developed world watches 5 to 6 hours of television a day. Apps are now available that offer an easily searchable interface for all of your programming, broadcasting, cable, pay TV, and the internet video suppliers like Netflix and Hulu. These will eventually make the DVR obsolete, as all your content's going to be stored in a cloud locker. Then, just to make it interesting, throw in virtual reality sex and companions. If you run a movie studio, television network, cable company, casino, theater, opera house, film festival, video sharing website, social network, radio station, or any one of hundreds of other entertainment businesses, your thinking better be big and bold. Mobile changes everything. Again, mobile is going to change how we buy, how we sell, how we connect, how we learn, and basically how we do almost everything. We are fast approaching the point where there will be 5 billion smartphones on the planet, and no one knows how many smartwatches, other wearables, or even implant devices will be in use. You're probably mindful of the increasing use of mobile apps because you're using them more and you see people using them more. But it's still unlikely that you're really cognizant of just how disruptive they will actually be over the next decade. Everything in business, and lots of other things, runs on marketing. During the next 10 years, mobile apps will disrupt marketing more than newspapers, radio, direct mail, television, and the internet did combined. And if you're in marketing, you better think of that last sentence again. There are two essential reasons for this. Apps intuitively bring local into the dynamic, and apps often remove control from the advertiser and empower consumers. So let's look at each of these, beginning with the local dynamic. Not to analyze how technology will change, as fascinating as that may be, but in terms of how the changes in mobile are going to require a higher level of thinking from all of us as entrepreneurs. Merge GPS technology with the revolution of users creating internet content and control. Add the explosion of mobile devices, and you have a recipe for disruption in the advertising space that'll be on a scale we have never witnessed before. Mobile apps do for the internet what those Valpak mailers did for direct mail. That is, if Valpak could have had a spy under your bed who could immediately sneak out and place coupons in your mailbox for products or services just moments after you had mentioned you wanted to buy them. Think this is wildly futuristic? Think again. Mobile apps give marketers opportunities they could only previously dream of. Neighborhood businesses like nail salons, barber shops, restaurants, they can SMS coupons and introductory offers to people as they drive or walk by, and soon in their when they go by in their land speeders like Star Wars. Mobile apps are going to offer advertisers segmenting, targeting, and immediacy in ways they've never had before. This gives advertisers powerful control, putting them in the driver's seat to proactively target their best prospects. Conversely, they're also going to lose control because a large percentage of the most popular apps will be produced by third parties, not the actual businesses who want to promote through them. So while you would still probably want to create an app to offer to your prospects and customers, the way they use it and the benefits to you might pale in comparison to what comes through apps created by others. Let me use the airline industry as an example. You can certainly expect that airlines like Delta, British Airways, and Lufthansa will continue to offer apps. If you're in their frequent flyer programs like I am, you're going to be a big user of them. But the apps most coveted and used by road warriors will be the ones created by outsiders. Those that tell them which airlines offer the most legroom, what airports offer a massage spa, what restaurants are closer to their departure gate, whether that hard-to-find souvenir is in the connecting or arrival airport, how to snag an aisle seat that has an empty middle seat adjacent to it, what alternate routing might get them double or triple frequent flyer points, what airline is offering a movie from this decade instead of last decade, how long the mechanical delay will really be, and of course each airline's ratings on food quality, late departures, lost bags, pilot safety, all of the things they would rather you did not know. See, the American Airlines app will probably neglect to tell you that your code share connection with their partner airline at JFK means you're going to have to go downstairs, reclaim your bags, and then schlep them through a dingy, filthy terminal to another building, probably having to take a bus or a train out in the snow. But the third-party app will. The app from your neighborhood deli would allow you to pre-order your meal for pickup or delivery, but it'll probably not advise you of the pending health department citations or will neglect to mention the unresolved food poisoning litigation that the third-party app does. Your neighborhood beauty salon app will probably allow you to schedule your pedicure, but only the third-party app will reveal that an alarming number of patrons who use credit cards at that salon have all become subsequent victims of identity theft. Apps are dramatically changing buying habits already. David Mathis, he's the developer from Fewer Pixels, said, "Consumers today are devouring as many as 10 or more pieces of related content in advance of making an online purchase. In 2008, that number was only 3. The clear and obvious reason for this is mobile. Never before has so much content been available to the masses and quite literally in the palm of their hands." Here's the thing about all the bold and brash predictions about mobile. They're already not big enough. Someone's going to do something with GPS and crowdsourcing reviews that no one else has thought of. It will seem obvious when it arrives because everyone will want it. But right now, you're probably hearing a voice in your head that says some of these won't work, and some of these won't catch on, and some of these will be too expensive to bother with. And you're right. Many won't work. But the ones that do, they're going to be game changers. Mobile isn't important because people like to stare at their phones. It's important because it means that from now going forward, people have powerful computers with them at all times, especially and including every time they're making a buying decision. Many of these phones are now digital wallets, and the ones that aren't can become so with apps. All offer the benefit of needing only a single password. You can leave your wallet and cash at home and just take your smartphone or wearable with you. When you're studying any market, the smart plan is to follow the money. In this case, it's follow how people will be paying without using actual money. Here's the salient issue about mobile apps, and the one that marketers and entrepreneurs seem to completely miss. The reason third-party apps are taken off and will continue to accelerate is because they are built with a different mindset and perspective. Most businesses build their apps with the mindset of, how do we squeeze the most profit from our customers? When third-party developers build apps, they do it with the mindset of how customers actually want to use your product or service, how they like to buy and why. We know that a free market economy is constantly being revolutionized from within. But who could imagine the creative destruction that would be caused by the smartphone and the apps it runs? Look at the monumental upheaval caused in the taxi business by something as simple as ride-sharing apps as Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar. Apps like these won't just force us to start thinking differently about marketing. They're going to force us to think differently about everything. Let's explore this deeper. We have a conflict between marketers who are now able to target potential prospects with an offer just at the point where they can buy, and consumers who control content, evaluate merchants, and drive the buying process. And it's going to get bloody. And the entrepreneurs who figure it out first on both sides will be the big winners. At the time I wrote this manifesto, the Google valuation is 28 times its trailing earnings, while Microsoft is at 18 and Apple is only at 10. A big reason is mobile. Google gives away their Android operating system at no charge to smartphone manufacturers. That allows them to include Google Search, thus giving them strong market share in mobile search. Companies that control mobile search can amass beefy profits by directing browsers to their own offerings and or simply facilitating leads, sales, or payments to others. But the force driving mobile is much larger than money. It's human needs and our desire to have them met faster, easier, and better. Look no further than an app developed by Jason DeSilva. Jason is an emerging documentary director, and he had his life changed at age 25 when he developed the beginning stages of multiple sclerosis. He began to have difficulty walking, and he went from needing a cane to a walker to a wheelchair or a scooter. And of course, since he's a documentary maker, he made a documentary about it, which is titled When I Walk. It's a gripping must-see film. His frustration at finding accessible restaurants and stores and restrooms led him to start AXS Map, which is now morphed into a movement to map out a searchable database of accessible sites. Access Map, ASXMap.com. Are your customers in need of something that mobile doesn't currently deliver? Can you bring it to them? If your answers are yes and no, respectively, you're in trouble. Just because you can't do it doesn't mean no one else can either. Big data turnaround. The ironic thing about the development of all these third-party apps is how they will flip-flop the dynamics of big data. Think back of the height of the dot-com boom. There was this hysterical series in the Dilbert cartoon strip. You know Wally, he's that engineer that works with Dilbert. Wally took the last three hairs on each side of his head and he tied them into a ponytail. This magical combination of being an engineer, having a ponytail, and using tech buzzwords hypnotized venture capitalists to invest millions of dollars with his non-existent startup venture. There's a similar mania today surrounding the words big data. If you're a professional speaker or conference presenter, no matter what industry you're speaking to, you can guarantee a packed room if you just include the words big data in your program title somewhere. Companies everywhere are salivating over the prospect of how they can slice and dice data to micro-target offers at exactly the right instant to exactly the right prospects. And the power this offers from a marketing perspective cannot be overstated. However, the tidal wave of third-party process apps we're about to see will help consumers take a lot of that power back. This could equalize the playing field or could even dramatically give the edge to consumers. These apps will allow the market to buy things more easily, get better service, and drive down prices. A perfect example is an app called Rental Picks, a picture-taking app developed by a former rental car agency franchisee named Mark Duffy. He originally developed this camera system in his car rental business. Now he sold that business and he spun off the app for consumers. Many customers, myself included, feel that the car rental companies are too aggressive on damage claims and they operate these divisions as profit centers. Most people, like me, don't really go around and check their car everywhere for every little scratch and ding, and then you bring them back and find yourselves being charged for damage when you return the car. What Duffy's app does is allow you to easily take and organize before and after photos of your rental car and even shows you what to photograph. This is just one example of what will likely be millions of cases where technology is developed for a business, then turned around and used by its customers instead. Just as companies can analyze volumes of data about how customers buy, apps are going to let potential customers analyze volumes of data about how companies actually deliver and at what cost. This is the free market economy at its best. So it's not a development that if you're a marketer, you should fear, but one you should recognize for the opportunity it will bring. Because if you have a business offering real value, transparency is never a threat. If you're an entrepreneur reading this right now, here are the questions you need to be asking. What kind of app can I create that makes it easier for my customers to buy from me?